At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. There's some retail in the program today, a little bit of Facebook as well. Also, a chat with Chuck Lorre, he of the Big Bang Theory, among many others. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's 24th day of February today, and we are going to begin with a relationship, housing and its influence on retail, big box stores specifically, in the business of home improvement. We learned this week that sales of previously owned homes hit a six-month high last month. Prices on those homes are up as well, so it's perhaps not too big a surprise that retailers with ties to housing are doing all right. Home Depot reported better-than-expected earnings yesterday, ditto for Lowe's today. So Marketplace's Annie Baxter starts us off with a look at what is working to those companies' advantage.
Over the past year, Ryan Togren has been finishing the basement of his home near Buffalo, and he's bought about $3,500 worth of stuff from Home Depot.
Everything from the studs slash wood to frame the area, drywall, a new saw.
Meanwhile, he scaled back his spending at other retailers. That means no new TV for the newly finished basement. He and his wife settled for putting an old one down there.
That sounds really first world problems and ridiculous, but it was a smaller TV, so we made kind of those trade-offs.
Wedbush security surveys have shown many consumers want to spend money on their homes rather than on apparel or electronics lately. Analyst Seth Basham cites confidence in the improving housing market and says it's good for Home Depot and Lowe's.
Their sales trends are much better than the rest of the retail industry.
Another plus for these home improvement companies, they don't have to compete as aggressively for customers with Amazon, according to Morningstar analyst Jamie Katz.
Nobody's going to ship lumber or safes or, really heavy products. So, yeah, they're insulated in certain categories.
Katz expects Lowe's and Home Depot to keep doing well this year as home prices continue to rise. That's the kind of trend Connecticut homeowner Mike Marino is watching. He wants to sell, but first, he's renovating a bathroom.
No one wants a nasty salmon pink 1962 bathroom.
He recently dropped about $8,000 at Home Depot to upgrade that bathroom and another one before listing his home. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Continuing with that theme here for a second of retail and the modern American economy, a corporate buzzword now, the last mile. The final distance, poetically speaking, of course, between the infrastructure set up to get you, the consumer, whatever it is you want. For our purposes, we're talking the stuff you've ordered online, groceries, clothes, Chinese takeout, whatever. That distance between that infrastructure and your front door. As companies like Amazon and Google and even Whole Foods get into same-day delivery, more and more startups are fighting to be that last-mile deliverer. Today, there are reports that Whole Foods is investing in Instacart. UPS is said to be sinking a wad into Deliv. That's a same-day delivery company out of Palo Alto up in the Bay Area. But whether there is actually enough demand out there right now for all that delivery supply? Yeah, that's the question. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the answer.
It takes Topher Lambert an hour each way by train to go to the nearest Costco.
When I moved to New York City, where I live in the heart of downtown now in Battery Park, Your time is really your most valuable asset.
So Lambert orders his nuclear winter supply of frozen meatballs through Instacart and pays a fee to have it delivered.
So I'm willing to pay that to get the run to Costco that I normally wouldn't have.
Lambert also uses Instacart for certain items from Whole Foods. The beleaguered retail chain has been benefiting from that kind of shopping. In its recent earnings report, the company said Instacart sales have been a bright spot. Paula Rosenblum is a retail analyst with RSR Research.
There's always been a market for home delivery and grocery. The challenge has been finding a way to make it profitable.
Rosenblum says that's because personalized on-demand delivery lacks benefits of scale. But for the company that figures out how to make instant delivery work, and lots of them are trying Uber Rush, Google Express, Amazon Flex, Arun Sundararajan of New York University's Business School says they'll own a new e-commerce category, local shopping.
The company that controls that interface and has the logistics locally to be able to fulfill local retail on demand could be potentially sitting on a massive market.
But first, he says, they have to be convenient and cheap enough to convince people that having your milk delivered makes more sense than going to the grocery store. In Chicago, I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
Started low, ended high on Wall Street today, just like they always promise us it will, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All you wanted was a dislike button, but no. Today, Facebook announced five new ways you can respond to a post on that site. That's in addition to the clearly boring old like button, which has been around since 2009, by the way. The new reactions are called reactions, and they're basically five animated emoji. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here to give us her reaction. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, I got to get this out of the way because I'm not the only one who's asking. You got to help me understand why this matters.
Well, I mean, it matters because everyone uses it. And if you've looked around at all today, everyone is talking about it. But also newsfeed, you know, it's Facebook's single most valuable property. And the like button actually gets clicked about 6 billion times a day.
No, really?
Wow. Billions of times. So it generates a ton of data about how users interact and what posts they like. That helps Facebook sort of craft the newsfeed. And if they get that right, then you stay interested and you click on things, and those things include ads. And people, and honestly, people want this. They've been asking for something like this for years, at minimum a dislike button.
That's right.
And instead we have these five new ways to express our feelings: love and laughter and a big surprise wow, a sad face and a mad face.
That's all we get is five? Because honestly, there's so much more you want to say on Facebook.
Well, okay, that's what I would have thought too. And Facebook put this huge team of data scientists on this. And at first, they got this behavioral scientist and he said, listen, you're going to need at least 20 different emoji because there's no way. So they decided to break it down. Here's Tom Allison. He's an engineering lead at Facebook.
Okay.
In particular, they looked at short comments. So these 1 to 3 word comments that people leave on posts, they're things like, you know, awesome or yay or congratulations. It turns out that, you know, when you kind of put them into categories, there were really 4 or 5 different types of comments outside of like that people were leaving on posts.
And that's it. They tested these across various countries. They ran them against various cultural issues. And they found that love, laughter, excitement, sorrow, and rage are basically universal human sentiments. It's kind of deep.
Universal sentiment as translated on Facebook. Okay, let me get back to the whole data thing, right? What does Facebook then get out of this by these five emoticons?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely something in it for Facebook. They do get more nuanced data. I mean, one Gartner analyst already described the data generated just by the like button as priceless. So now they're able to see what kind of posts we really love or that make us mad. So they get more useful information for crafting the news feed. And then here is Tom Allison again with the big thing.
So you will be able to leave reactions on ads. And I think that this will actually help advertisers understand how people are responding to their content.
So basically, brands that have pages, they immediately get access to these data breakdowns on the reactions that people leave on posts.
Yeah.
And pretty soon, Facebook will roll out tools to advertisers that will also give them detailed reports. And you can imagine, this is going to be a treasure trove that helps shape messaging all over Facebook. And that's where the money is.
Man, Facebook taking over the world. Emoji
that's right.
by
don't you
emoji
it?
By emoji. No, I don't heart it. Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent. See ya.
My pleasure, Kai. Bye.
Coming up.
I don't want to take it for granted. I don't want to take it for granted that it's automatically going to pop out episodes that we're proud of.
200 episodes of The Big Bang Theory later. Showrunner Chuck Lorre on where the ideas come from. But first, let's do the numbers. In a late-day rally, the Dow Industrials gained 53 points, 0.3%, ended things at 16,484. The NASDAQ up 39 points, 0.8%, 45.42. The S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.4%, 1929. Uh-oh, troubling number there year-wise. Chesapeake Energy said it lost, I was a history major. Chesapeake Energy said it lost more than $14 billion last year because of write-downs forced by low oil prices. As bad as that sounds, the company beat expectations and Chesapeake shares rose almost 23% today. That stock, by the way, still down about 44.0% for the year. Oil prices, since we're talking about it, ticked up 0.9%, $32.15 a barrel today. You are listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's been a lousy stretch down in Brazil the past year or so. There's been the Zika virus most recently. The economy is in trouble, to put it mildly. And then back in November, the country suffered its worst ever mining disaster. A mining dam collapsed. At least 17 people died, and the mine's owners were hit with fines of more than $90 million. Environmental groups have said the long-term damage from that disaster would come to $27 billion to fix. And after initially asking for $5 billion from the companies, Brazilian prosecutors have now demanded double that. Because in Brazil and here in the U.S. as well, it's really tough to figure out the costs of disaster. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on that.
When environmental disaster happens in this country, the government and a bunch of lawyers are tasked with determining who's to blame and what they should pay. Wade Martin teaches economics at Cal State Long Beach. He says it's not an easy task.
What are you monetizing? Are you monetizing, okay, the fishery is depleted, or are you monetizing the non-market value of the way of life? How do you put a dollar value on that?
In the U.S., the process is called natural resource damage assessment. It was set up after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. The regulation isn't established rules, more like guidelines.
It's not a cookbook, however.
Rick Dunford owns a company called Environmental Economic Services. He says it's tough to put a dollar value on sea otters and penguins.
You can't really go to Walmart and buy a seabird.
William K. Riley co-chaired President Obama's commission on the BP oil spill in the Gulf. He says the process is more art than science, and it also depends on who the culprits are.
You look at how big they are, what kind of signal it will send.
And companies are taking note of the signals prosecutors are sending. To minimize potential liabilities, many work with communities beforehand to try to explain the risks of what they're doing. Again, Wade Martin.
But the understanding of the risk at the community level may not be the same as the understanding of the risk from the mining sector.
A community may face relocation, even obliteration. A company faces the shutdown of one location and, of course, potential litigation. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We were talking about Zika a minute ago. While there is some evidence that the virus is being transmitted sexually here in the United States, most cases have likely been contracted through mosquito bites down in Latin America. The mosquito in question, the one responsible for transmitting the virus, is technically an invasive species and has, in point of fact, been eradicated in dozens of places in the Americas over the past 100 years. It's been eradicated multiple times, actually. And think about that for a second. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains.
One big reason we have the Panama Canal today is successful mosquito eradication at the turn of the 20th century.
The French attempted the opening of the Panama Canal, but they had to abandon it because of fatalities due to infection to yellow fever and so forth.
Nikos Vasilakis is associate professor of pathology at the University of Texas. Once mosquitoes were controlled there by draining swamps and applying oils and chemicals, the canal could be built. In Brazil, a campaign in the 30s wiped out the same mosquito responsible for the Zika outbreak today.
They were going house to house, evaluating and observing what were the breeding habitats.
Telling people to get rid of old tires full of water or uncovered cisterns where the mosquitoes bred.
Applying fines to people that they were non-compliant and imprisonment if they were repeat offenders.
This was expanded to 18 countries in the 40s and 50s. DDT was added to the arsenal, millions of dollars were spent, and it was successful. And then it failed.
It failed because of its success.
For several years, officials saw no mosquitoes.
They wonder, well, why the hell we need to spend money maintaining this program? The problem is not here anymore, so we're good.
But they were not good. The mosquitoes came back in about a decade, and in many places, so did disease. There are examples, though, where dangerous insects have been controlled, in the long term even. Flesh-eating screwworms, that's a real creature, used to be found in Middle America until the U.S. started to go after them in the 50s.
And that was done by distributing radiation-sterilized male flies.
That's Dan Strickman with the Gates Foundation. The sterile flies caused the population to crash, and this was used to eradicate the worms all the way down to Colombia.
That is maintained to this day by release of sterile male screwworm flies in about a 100-kilometer section of Panama.
We are screwworm-free because a cloud of sterile flies has been protecting us in Panama for the past 62 years. There are similar strategies available for controlling disease-bearing mosquitoes today.
The newer experimental techniques are biologically based in the sense that they involve the release of altered mosquitoes that go out and in one way or another affect the rest of the population.
There are mosquitoes that have effectively been sterilized genetically. There are mosquito-specific hormone treatments that prevent them from developing. The options are numerous. The trick is implementing them and then not abandoning them when they work. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The water crisis in Flint has been a harsh reminder that basic services in this country can't always be taken for granted. Poisoned water in Flint, any water at all, in some places, as in nothing coming out of the tap, often with no notice and sometimes lasting for days. That's real, and it happens regularly to the millions of people in this country who live in trailer parks. Lewis Wallace from WYSO visited one outside Dayton, Ohio.
I meet Jerry Reynolds by randomly knocking on her trailer door.
Hello. I'm sorry to bother you. I'm just working on a story about the water shutoffs and wandering around talking to folks. Well, sure. Thank you.
You'll have to excuse
me. Hi, Fluffy.
I've been sick. So.
She and her fluffy little white dog, Angel, welcome me inside. She collapses into her chair to talk. Reynolds says she's lived here at Pineview Estates for more than 25 years.
This was a real nice trailer park back then.
It was beautiful, she says, like in a magazine. Just a couple hundred trailers surrounded by cornfields. The problem these days is the water.
You just get up and it's off, and then, you know, you never know how long it's going to be off. You know, it's disgusting. When you can't take a shower, you can't flush your toilet, you can't do nothing, it's getting bad.
Reynolds and her neighbors usually don't even learn why their water is off. Sometimes it's as simple as a broken water main that takes days to fix. Sometimes the water comes out brown, or they get boil alerts taped to the door. Basically, it's an old system that just hasn't been updated. And here's the thing. Reynolds owns her trailer, but like most trailer park residents, she pays rent for the plot of land it's on. And the landlord manages the small well water system. Tenants here say they don't even know how to reach that landlord, Tim Deerwester. When I drop by the trailer that doubles as a rental office, the on-site manager asks not to be recorded and orders me out. Here I am.
Is there anybody I can contact? Anybody I could talk to about the water issue? Is there any phone number I can call?
I've left messages with the landlord's lawyer and his father and haven't heard back. But isn't reliable water, you know, a right? A researcher named Sylvia Gonzalez, a PhD student in urban planning at UCLA, had the same question. She started noticing lots of news stories around the country about places with water cutoffs.
And I was running the data, and I kept seeing that mobile homes kept popping up and popping up as having multiple violations, and so I was really intrigued.
So she and a colleague analyzed census data on mobile homes and water cutoffs and published a paper last year. They found trailer park residents are more than three times as likely as others to experience at least one water outage a year. Gonzalez says regulations and responses for these smaller water systems are all over the place.
The way that our water policies are structured, they're very, I wouldn't say they're structured actually, I would say that they're very fragmented.
At Pineview Estates, the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency has jurisdiction and has been going back and forth with the owner for years. Dina Pierce with Ohio EPA says that after the state's attorney general filed a lawsuit last month, the landlord did sign something agreeing to fix the problems.
We are doing everything we can within the regulatory framework to make sure that happens.
But last time I was at Pineview, the water was off again with no notice. Everyone woke up to 4 gallons per trailer of bottled water left on their porches late at night. Jerry Reynolds says most people here are just trying to get out.
Well, there's like 5 empty trailers across the street.
She doesn't want to go. She's put a lot of money into this trailer and she has health problems.
Well, I hope somebody can help us. We need it. We really do.
Finding good water should be easy. Pineview is right next to a river and right on top of an abundant underground aquifer. It's the water system, the human-made part, that's the problem. In Miamisburg, Ohio, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Tomorrow night on CBS, the number one sitcom on television is going to air its 200th episode, The Big Bang Theory. Sheldon, Leonard, and the gang is in its 9th season, the brainchild of writer and producer Chuck Lorre. Lorre's been in television for a while. He cut his teeth on Roseanne. He went on to create Grace Under Fire, Dharma and Greg, 2.5 Men, of course. Chuck Lorre, it's great to have you on.
Nice to be here.
Other than the sheer milestone-ness of it, what does 200 episodes mean to you as a television professional?
We have survived and actually flourished, which is a remarkable thing in this business. It doesn't happen too often. And when it happens and everyone is enjoying the process, you know, and you actually enjoy being on the set every day for 9 years. It sounds a bit treacly, but it's true. It's still a joy to do the show.
Do you go to the set every day?
Yeah.
But you're running like 3 or 4 shows. How do you do that?
I don't want to take it for granted. I don't want to take it for granted that it's automatically going to pop out episodes that we're proud of. Each episode has to be, I don't want to say belabored over, but we work really hard to make each one work.
It's not possible that after 200 tries of this thing, you're completely satisfied with every single one, right?
There are favorites, but you try not to leave on a Tuesday night when we shoot in front of an audience. We don't go home till we're satisfied with what we've got because We can't save these things in editing. There's no post-production on a situation comedy in front of an audience that can erase the mistakes or the weak moments. There's no cosmetic way to paper over the failures. So we grind it out on shoot night. We rewrite the material and try it again and again and again until we get something that we feel is worth putting on television.
I read a great quote about you as I was getting ready for this interview. You worried at some point in one of your other shows early on, like after 6 episodes or something, that you were just going to run out of ideas. Oh, my God, what do we do?
That actually happens on every series. Huh. You hit the wall periodically, and it seems to be in increments of 6. I don't know why. But there is that moment where you feel like there's no more stories to tell or none that are worth telling. And it's a kind of a quiet crisis moment, and then it passes, and more stories happen.
What is it about television for you? I mean, you started as a musician and you know, producing shows like Roseanne, and now, I mean, honestly, there are those who compare you to Norman Lear.
I've always looked at it as an extraordinary opportunity to put on a show, to tell a story, and hopefully make people laugh. You know, when I got started in the late 80s in television, I would sit in a room and there are people who would say, well, it's just a sitcom. It doesn't matter. It's just a situation comedy. It's good enough. Let's move on. And I was sitting there thinking, Well, that can't be right. I mean, this is an opportunity to communicate to maybe tens of millions of people. Why would we take it for granted? So that creates that kind of work ethic that makes you neurotic.
I want to talk about your most recent show, Mom, with Allison Janney and Anna Faris, about a not very funny topic, this idea of alcoholism and rehab. And I want to ask you two things about it. The first one is, give me the elevator pitch for that one.
From the very beginning, the idea was that recovery from addiction is possible. And it was fundamentally a series about hope that people can change, that people are not, you know, doomed to repeat the tragedies of their lives over and over and over again, that growth is possible. That was the not very funny premise of this from the beginning. And I was determined to try and find an arena where I could push the envelope a little bit in storytelling. It's hard to make it funny, but funny is possible.
Funny is possible, but and here comes the second part of the question. How carefully do you weigh turning people off with the seriousness of it? I mean, the show is, you know, critically really well received, but how, what's that balance for you as you're thinking about this?
I can only make a judgment based on my own response to the material. I can't presume to know what maybe perhaps millions of people might respond, but I know how I respond to the material and when we're sitting in a room full of comedy writers, and sometimes we have to ask ourselves, you know, this is a life and death situation for many, 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 many people. So let's not be glib. Let's not presume the comedy is there when it's not. And then it's just a leap of faith. I trust that the audience will stay with us, even if we step into the darkness.
Chuck Lorre, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, the Earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall. We built the pyramids. Math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang.
I love that song. This final note on the way out today, in which I'm not saying anything mean about millennials. I am just reporting the facts. From the New York Times, this item that in a recent survey, 40% of millennials said cereal was an inconvenient breakfast choice because they had to clean up after eating it. I report, you decide. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 53 points today, 0.3% after a very slow start. The NASDAQ up 39 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, 0.4%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.